We've been going through the fifth way. We've been going through the precepts of the fifth way, and we're going to keep doing that today. I've been kind of pounding on the law lately, pounding on obedience and the law. But you know, there's a reason for that. Just like we had to spend a lot of time on kingdom. Kingdom is such a big concept. It's so difficult for us to really get our minds and our arms wrapped around all that kingdom really means and how it profoundly changes every moment of our lives if we'll allow it to. Law is exactly the same way. You know, I don't think we really realize how deep that rabbit hole goes in terms of how we view our lives legally, how we view our society legally, our religion legally, and our spirituality, our relationship with God legally. These roots go so deep. I mean, go all the way back to, well, all the way back to the beginning, of course. Jesus was fighting the Pharisees and their legalism. But as soon as Christianity outgrew its little Jewish pot and moved into the Eastern Mediterranean, the Eastern Roman Empire, it got infused with Roman law, got infused with Greek philosophy, and it morphed and it changed. And the Roman Catholic Church in the West that held sway over even the kings of Europe for 1,000 years was all about control. It was modeled after the Roman Empire. You know, you had the Pope, you had the Emperor at the top, you had everything laying out in this neat pyramidal kind of hierarchy. And the whole point was control. The whole point was order. The whole point was keeping the flow of taxes coming back to Rome, coming back to the Vatican. I mean, it was all about control. And when the Protestant Reformation took place, because the abuses and the corruption had gotten so bad from Rome, the apple didn't fall far from the tree. The leading figures of the Reformation were Luther and Calvin. And John Calvin was a lawyer. Oh, yeah. Yeah, you can imagine what happened there. He was a French lawyer. Took up shop in Geneva. Transformed Geneva into what they called the Jerusalem of Europe. But the way he did it was with an iron fist. He had a very systematic theology. He had a very definite idea of what was right and what was wrong, and he made you conform. On the point of death, even. He oversaw executions, exilements, imprisonments, torture, just as the Roman Catholic Church had done centuries before and continued to do with the Spanish Inquisition. And then we come out to the United States, and we are the heirs to the Puritan tradition. And the Puritans took shape in England, but they were all about very definite ideas themselves. And if you ever heard of the Salem witch trials, which were conducted by the Puritans, most of the women who were sentenced and executed there, they weren't really witches, they were dissenters. And that control has just come through to us as law, obedience, adherence to doctrine, adherence to theology, adherence to a certain way of thinking. And that runs so deep with us. We really are about obedience. We hear it, I hear it on the radio all the time. It's about obedience. We have to obey the Lord's precepts, the Lord's commands. He will only bless our nation for as long as we are obedient to His precepts. It's all about obedience and it's about law. And we hear this over and over again. We spent last week talking about the difference between the micro and the macro. A huge concept. If we don't understand the difference between the macro groups, three or more, and the micro, one-on-one or individuals, we will never understand what Jesus is talking about. It is so difficult for us to get through to these concepts because they're not openly talked about or taught in our society these days. And so in the macro, yes, justice is the highest good. Everyone wondered why there's a difference between the Old Testament and the New Testament, the way it reads? Why is God so harsh? Why is God so, you know, wrathful in the Old Testament and so loving in the New Testament? The Old Testament is a macro book. The Old Testament is about the relationship between God and the nation of Israel. So the law is paramount. Justice, fairness is paramount. And so God looked at through that lens, looks wrathful. Looks like he is the one who is the ultimate judge, the ultimate executioner, the ultimate arbiter. The New Testament is a micro book. Jesus is talking to individuals. He's trying to turn individual heart lights on. He's telling them that the kingdom is within. It moves from the inside to the outside. And so God looked at through that lens. Looks like mercy. Looks like compassion. Looks like love. Same God. God doesn't change. It's just the way we look at Him. How do we look at God? How do you look at God? If we're going to look at God through the lens of the law, through the lens of justice, then He's going to look like a judge. He's going to look like someone who just looks at where you are on either side of that line and passes a sentence. But if we're looking at Him through love, if we're looking at Him through the lens that Jesus was giving us, that he spent so much time trying to redefine the lens, redefine the way that we look at Father, then He's going to look very different. And so this is extremely important for us to really consider law. Law. How are we supposed to look at law? Now, I've been pounding the law a lot, right? And so maybe we're just supposed to throw the law out. Not so fast, Kemosabe. No. And Jesus said at Matthew 5:20 that we need to exceed the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, which was all based on law, based on adherence to the law. But He also said, and why don't we just read that? I think that would make more sense. At Matthew 5:17, and it's in the bulletin. James is probably scrambling right now to get it up on the screens. Here's Jesus again. Do not think that I came to abolish the law or the prophets. I did not come to abolish, but to fulfill. Truly, I say to you, until heaven and earth pass away, not the smallest letter or stroke shall pass from the law until all is accomplished. That's a strong statement. It's a critical statement. Once again, Jesus is really defining His ministry, defining His approach. He didn't come to abolish the law, but He came to fulfill it. And what He's going to be telling us as we go through this is that in order to fulfill the intent of the law, sometimes we have to break the letter of the law. Huh? How does that work? Because the intent of the law, you know what the intent of the law is? The intent of the law is to preserve life, to preserve the integrity of the group. And in terms of the Old Testament law, the theocratic law of the Jews, it also had the intent and purpose of bringing the awareness of God's presence into every moment. Preserve life, increase awareness, promote awareness of God's presence. The Jews called it Shekinah, which literally meant this felt, even visible presence of God in their midst. That the law was supposed to bring that. So Jesus says, I didn't come to abolish that, but I came to fulfill its intent. And this whole next series of scriptures that we're going to be reading are Jesus' attempt to redirect, change the focus, change the lens. Because we are looking at God through one lens, and He wants us to look at God through a different lens. And so He's really going to go at this with the Pharisees. But this second part of what He says here is fascinating. For I tell you, until heaven and earth pass away, not the smallest letter or stroke shall pass from the law until all is accomplished. And the key phrase there is pass away. Because pass away in Aramaic, the language that Jesus spoke, is abar. And abar literally means to cross a boundary, to cross a threshold. So what Jesus is saying here is until heaven and earth. And you have to understand that the Jews believe that we humans live between heaven and earth, between the unity and connection of God and His realm, and the individual form and particles that we can see, that ability to see ourselves as separate from someone else, to feel loneliness, to feel apartness, is what earth experience is all about. And we live between the two. And our job as human beings is to bring heaven to earth and earth to heaven. In other words, to cross their boundaries and merge the two. What is Jesus saying here? He says, until heaven and earth merge, until their boundaries cross and they become one thing. The law is necessary. The law will exist for as long as we feel that apartness. The law will exist for as long as we need a guide, something to help us to continue to do our jobs as humans, which is to bring heaven to earth and earth to heaven. Which then begs the question, what does law mean? Because we think of law as law. It comes to us from the Greek nomos, which meant law much like our law. You know, some kind of legal instrument, some kind of iron agenda. But Torah, to the Jews, was instruction or guidance. And so the law is more like that hand at the small of your back, guiding you, hands on your shoulders, kind of helping you to steer away from the real difficult extremes and the dangerous places. Until heaven and earth merge, until they are one experience, one reality, there will always be the need for the guide to bring us to and keep us moving toward that reality. This is what Jesus is trying to tell us right here, right now. So how are we supposed to view law? How are we supposed to then take a look at this? As I said, we look at it typically as an absolute instrument for obedience. Here is the law, we need to obey. But I want to read you a little excerpt from this chapter in the fifth way, and let's see if we can start reframing this. By this point, it may seem fair to assume that kingdom exists in the micro to foster compassion and mercy, while the law is an instrument of the macro to ensure justice. In reality, the relationship between kingdom and the law is not so dualistic, not so bipolar. It's much more connected and beautiful than that. Far from being separate forces working in different spheres or a succession of forces, one superseding the other, kingdom and Torah law are really exactly the same thing as viewed from opposite sides of the micro-macro divide. Law begins its work in the macro and filters into the micro, into the lives of individuals under the law. And kingdom begins in the micro, in the heart of each individual, and then breaks forth into the macro. Or alternately, law and kingdom can be viewed simply as a cause and its effect. Looked at this way, kingdom does not supersede Torah law. Law is the cause and kingdom is its effect. But then in the same way, the effect of kingdom is to fulfill the law, to make our lives look like law, but without the need for obedience. See, the effect of law is not obedience. That's what we would probably say. What's the effect of law? That everyone obeys, that everyone complies. It's not. The effect of law, if lived right, if viewed right, if the process of this instruction is right, the effect is going to be kingdom. It's going to be that resonance with the values of the King, God. And the effect of kingdom is freedom. Freedom, but not freedom in terms of anarchy, not in terms of everybody doing their own thing, but freedom from obedience in the sense that we now really resonate with the King's values. We feel them, we live them, we value them ourselves inside. So in God's kingdom, in God's reign, kingdom looks like law, but we're free from obedience at the same time. We bring preservation of life, bringing awareness of God's presence. I don't know if all this is coming through. It's sometimes the concepts are really a little strange at first. Can we be free from obedience and at the same time look exactly like the law? From the outside in, we look like we're perfectly obedient, yet from the inside out, we're completely free to do exactly what we want to do, but what we want to do looks like law. This is kingdom. It's a complete circle. God's deepest purpose and desire, His pleasure and delight, is distilled down into the behavioral code of the law, a dictatorial macro rule for people to obey. But law only becomes fulfilled as it becomes kingdom. In those individuals who find their way to write the law on their hearts, to desire exactly what God desires, then as kingdom breaks forth from those transformed hearts in the micro and expands outward, ultimately fulfilling law in the macro community, making obedience obsolete by turning that law back into kingdom, the pleasure and purpose of God from whom it came. So, this is what Jesus is telling us. Until heaven and earth merge, until the reign of unity, God's kingdom, is mirrored in our society, the law is necessary. Think of it this way. Have you ever made Jell-O? Who's made Jell-O? Hey, good, Aaron. One of the guys made Jell-O. Oh, there's another one. All right, good. Jell-O. You ever made Jell-O in a Jell-O mold? Ever use a Jell-O mold? Okay. One person made a Jell-O mold. I think you get the idea. You got a mold. Maybe it's one of those funny fish or something like that. And you pour the liquid jello into the mold and you let it sit there and set there long enough. So eventually what can you do? You can pull the mold away and the jello still looks like the mold. See, the Hebrews originally envisioned law this way. That we take our lives and we pour them into the mold of the law. And if we hold it there long enough, if we live there long enough, if we allow ourselves to stay compliant long enough, eventually you can take the law away and we look like the law. The Old Testament calls us having the law written on our hearts. This is the thing we need to understand. We become the law. We don't obey the law anymore. We are law. We are kingdom when we allow ourselves to stay in that place long enough. There was a science fiction novel written by Ray Bradbury, Fahrenheit 451. Anyone remember that one? There was a pretty bad movie made from it, but there was a movie made from it. Anyway, it looks forward into an Orwellian future where the government has banned all books. Okay? And firemen don't come to put out fires. Firemen come if they find books in your house, and they come to burn the books. And this is the way this works. And so books are completely banned. But people who love books so much have moved out into the wilderness, out into the forest, and they've each chosen a book that is their book. And they memorize the book. And they constantly recite the book. They become the book. They teach the book to the next generation. They even forget their own names. They become the book. Hi, I'm Tale of Two Cities. Good to meet you. You know, imagine that, losing your name completely, completely becoming this book, steeping in it, reciting it over and over again. This is starting to get us toward what the Old Testament is talking about at Deuteronomy 6. Take a listen. Deuteronomy 6, 4 through 9. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your might. These words which I am commanding you today shall be on your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your sons, and shall talk of them when you sit in your house, and when you walk by the way, when you lie down, and when you rise up. You shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as frontals on your forehead. You shall write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates. To becoming the book. Constant recitation, constant awareness, constant passing on to the next generation. A little bit more from the fifth way. In molding the people, Torah regulated every aspect of Hebrew life. From the moment the people arose in the morning to the moment they laid down at night, almost every moment in between contained a command. What they wore, what they ate, how they prepared what they ate, how they fashioned the objects of worship, when and how they worshipped, how they related to each other, when they prayed, and how they prayed. The very tassels on their prayer shawls were knotted to match the numerical equivalents of the letters of the name of God. A contemporary Jew says that even today there is a morning prayer of thanksgiving to God for returning their souls to them for another day. Don't you love that? You pray to God to thank Him for returning your soul to you for another day. There are prayers before enjoying material pleasures, such as eating or wearing new clothes. Prayers before performing ritual functions, such as lighting candles or washing hands. Prayers to recite upon seeing anything unusual, like a king or a rainbow or a great tragedy. Prayers to say whenever something good or bad happens and before bed at night. All in addition to regularly scheduled prayers 3 times a day and those said at synagogue. Could you imagine if we had prayers every time you saw a rainbow? Every time an ambulance went by, you'd have a prayer for that because something bad, someone could be in distress and you'd pray for them. Prayers for everything constantly throughout the day. Does that sound oppressive to you to have that kind of law regulating every aspect of your life? Yeah, it does to us because we look at law as restrictive. We look at law as limiting our freedoms. But think of it maybe more like a school uniform. I had to wear school uniforms. Some of you had to wear school uniforms. Now, on one hand, you gripe about it all the time because you got to wear the uniform. On the other hand, it's completely freeing because you don't have to worry about what you're wearing today. And you don't have to worry about whether you have enough money to keep up with Sally Jones, who's got all the money for all the latest stuff. And it's really freeing when you actually approach it that way. And some people laugh, you know, joked me because I have sort of a uniform here that I wear all the time. I got my black shirt and I got my... You know what? We went... Frank and I went to a... I do. It makes it really easy for me. Frank and I went to a seminar where there was a Methodist pastor there, and he was wearing the Roman collar, the blacks. We call them the blacks in the order. So the Roman collar, black shirt. And then he had regular jeans on, but he wore the black. And every single day of the seminar, he wore a shirt. Finally, I got a chance to talk to him and said, you know, what's with the shirt? He says, you know what? I just found out it was a lot easier just to be able to get up and wear this every day. I don't have to think about it. You know what? And I always get free parking at hospitals. Works great. You know, someday I'm going to show up in a Roman collar and just freak you all out. But it would be so nice if I didn't have to even feel a little bit self-conscious about wearing the same thing every Sunday. That would be really nice. It would be freeing if we all understood that this regulation was part of pastoral dress. You know, so he has to wear that. But for me inside, it would be like, yeah, I don't have to think. I got all my black shirts. I got all my tan slacks. I just put them on. If you look at law this way, it frees you. You know what your day looks like. Do you know how hard we work sometimes with clients here to get them to set a grid for their lives? So that you don't wake up in the day and you just have this gray expanse of day and you don't know anything, you know, and just it's like, what do I do with this day? And you order your day. You set down all the things that you're going to do, the set pieces and the different things. And then you just get up and you just do what the paper tells you to do. The law does that for you. It sets all of the markers of your day. You have something to move toward and to move away from. And if you allow it to be that, it can be so freeing and allow you to be able to exercise within that freedom, the love and the connection that we're talking about. What is Paul talking about when he talks about praying without ceasing? He's not talking about a constant stream of thoughts or words. He's talking about a seamless and connected awareness of God's presence. Literally, these people, if they were really following the law, couldn't walk more than 10 steps without being reminded of God's presence in some way. Reminded of their relationship to God and what they needed to do before their God. And to us, it seems so oppressive, so difficult. And maybe to some of them it did as well, especially as the Pharisees got involved. But the truth of the matter is, if we approach it from this way that Jesus is looking at it, everything changes. Everything takes us into another direction. But of course, it never lasts. You know, the greatest thing that we can build up, we talk about revivals all the time. A revival is only going to last as long as that generation lasts that experienced the revival, if it isn't passed down to the next generation. And it's difficult to pass down to the next generation. How many of you who have parents have had trouble instilling your values in your children and really seeing them live those, especially through the teenage years? Yeah, it's very difficult to do. And so often these revivals, they come and they flower and then they die again within the same generation because they aren't passed down to the next generation. And this idea of the law, this Camelot idea of the Old Testament law, did not get passed down to the generations in the same way. It's human nature for each generation to look for their own way of doing things. And so the idea of the law started to lose this deep meaning. Now that section that we talked about where God is talking to the people, the law shall be written on your hearts. It shall be as frontals on your head and on your arms, and it'll be you need to write it on your doorposts and on the gates. The people took that literally. They literalized that. Ever heard of phylacteries? Tefillin in Hebrew. They're leather boxes that were, you know, tooled and embossed, and then inside would put scrolls of these scriptures, and they would strap them to their foreheads and strap them to their right arms. Ever heard of a mezuzah? Mezuzah? Yeah, it's a little metal container that was nailed to the doors. Actually, the Jews started writing the scriptures on the lintels and on their doorposts in ancient times. Moving forward, they put them on a scroll, put them inside this metal box, and affix it to the door. And there are rules about all this stuff. The way that you put on your tefillin, the way that you affix the mezuzah had to go on the right side of the inside of the door casing. There's a big controversy whether it had to go horizontally or go vertically. And the Ashkenazi in Eastern Europe, they tilted it, always toward the room in which you were entering, right? It had to be put 2/3 of the way up, about shoulder height on the door. And if you were renting your house in the diaspora, that is outside of Israel, you had to have your mezuzah up within 30 days of moving in. But if you owned your house or you were living in Israel, you had to put it up immediately. And that parchment better not be crumpled or in any way destroyed, otherwise it completely destroyed the use of the mezuzah. Lots of rules about mezuzahs. Lots of rules about tefillin. Missing the entire point that God wasn't talking about physical things. He was talking about as if it were right here in the front of your mind. Always, the first thought is of these things, of your God. And your right arm was the arm of action. So right there, with every action, with every thought, here is God. That was the beauty of it. Now maybe at the beginning, this is meant as a physical reminder of that deep spiritual fact. But after a few generations, what happens? Now it's just the physical. The meaning behind it gets lost. Unless that individual writes it on their heart. And then it becomes a beautiful thing again. But one of the hallmarks of Jesus' teaching is the outward expression means nothing if the heart's not right. Come on. We have to think about these things. And so here we go, you know. It doesn't last. A physical reminder. The original law was really simple. It gets really complex, of course. Just like the U.S. Constitution. We talked about this a few weeks ago. 4,000 words. How many lines of code in the U.S. law, federal law now? 76,400. It was a rhetorical question, but okay. I asked a lawyer. What can I say? See what I'm talking about? And then if you add all the other statutes and the IRS statutes and the state statutes, you've got millions of lines of code interpreting 4,000 words of the original Constitution, not to mention the Bill of Rights. You get the point. The same thing happened with the Jewish law. And the Pharisees taking what they saw as 613 laws, written laws in the Torah, they extrapolated that into thousands of rules that they called hedges around the other law. The people were so burdened with this, they couldn't even think straight. This is what Jesus is trying to get a lever in and wedge that power away from the Pharisees, because they had set themselves up as arbiters, as lawyers, as middlemen between the people and their God. And Jesus could not tolerate that, because he knew that the Father lives in the micro. The Father's relationship with us is in the micro. It has nothing to do with all that stuff. All that stuff doesn't get in the way unless it's the guide that's funneling us toward that micro-relationship as it's supposed to. But it had become something else by now. Where is kingdom in all of this? Of course, kingdom is completely lost. A lot of people look at Jesus as a revolutionary, really trying to buck the system, as a social activist, trying to break down the system. They see Jesus as a champion of women, which he was. A champion of children, which he was. The champion of the poor, all of the marginalized, all of those that were seen as property in the ancient world. But Jesus was dealing with each individual woman that he met, not women. Jesus wasn't interested in working from the top down, trying to change society in the macro. He was interested in working from the bottom up. Do you know that all lasting change always comes from the bottom up, not from the top down? It is the individual people changing their hearts, changing the way that they relate, that changes the culture for lasting periods, not coerced from the top down. Laughingly, I heard one social, I don't know what he was, if he was supposed to be a Bible interpreter, he was more of a sociologist, but he saw Jesus as a social activist. He saw Jesus as the original proponent of the separation of church and state. And he used as his text Jesus telling us, when you pray, don't pray as the hypocrites do out in the marketplace. Go into your secret place. Go into the closet. So he said that's Jesus taking prayer out of the marketplace, out of the state, and into the private place. And he was the original proponent. Completely misses the point of everything that Jesus was about. Had nothing to do with church and state. Jesus wasn't about the macro. He was about the micro that would expand into the macro. But he started there. He wasn't iconoclastic. He wasn't trying to tear down these dear symbols. And he wasn't trying to deconstruct. He was trying to fulfill the intent, the original intent of the law. And his message and his ministry is all micro. All about showing individual people their Father in heaven and the relationship that they can have. And Jesus upheld the Torah law. You know, don't make any mistake there. How do we know that Jesus was absolutely adherent to the Torah law? One of the ways we can know is because the Pharisees actually talked to him. The Pharisees invited him into their homes. The Pharisees followed him around. The Pharisees were these arbiters of the law. If Jesus had been anything less than a perfect follower of the law, they could have dismissed him out of hand, and they would have done everything that they could to avoid even touching the edge of his robes, or they would be defiled. But because they accepted him, we know that they saw him as one of them. Some scholars believe Jesus was a Pharisee because his teaching is much more like the Pharisees than any of the other major groups of Judaism. He could have been. It's possible. And then he took this detour, this turn, as he realized who his Father really is. And if for no other reason, the people and the Pharisees called him Rabbi. Rabboni, which means teacher. A title reserved for someone who was a teacher of the law, a doctor of the law. But Jesus was not in the business of following law. He was in the business of fulfilling law in kingdom, which means he went out of his way at every turn to break the Pharisees' oral tradition. These are all the hedges, all the rules that they had put around the law to keep you from actually breaking a law. And he was trying to show the people how those oral rules, those traditions that they were expected to fulfill on pain of punishment, were actually subverting the intent of the law. Let's take a look. I'm going to show you a couple of scriptures here, show you how Jesus does it because it's brilliant. At Matthew 12, verse 1, at that time, Jesus went through the grain fields on the Sabbath. He uses the Sabbath as his testing ground. The Sabbath is the perfect place for him. It's like his petri dish to be able to grow these cultures and see how the people, it was the clearest way for the people to see the abuses that were being heaped on them. And what this was all about. Remember, the purpose of the law is to preserve life, to bring awareness of God's presence. The Sabbath is what? It's about refreshment. It's about rest at the end of a long week, which is steeped in the details of daily living, to have one day that you set aside to bring the awareness of God's presence back into your life, to refresh, to refill, to refrain from work. It's a beautiful concept. But the Pharisees had turned it into just a huge, onerous set of rules. 39 categories of things that you couldn't do on the Sabbath around the one thing, to just not do any servile work. And those were categories. They were called melacha. Inside of those were toledot, other categories. Inside of those were shavut, other categories. Dozens and dozens of rules just around this one thing to keep the Sabbath. So, at that time, Jesus goes to the grain fields on the Sabbath, and his disciples became hungry and began to pick the heads of the grain and eat. But when the Pharisees saw this, they said to him, "Look, your disciples do what is not lawful on a Sabbath." But Jesus says to them, "Have you not read what David did when he became hungry and his companions, how he entered the house of God, how they ate the consecrated bread, which was not lawful for them to eat nor those with him, but for the priests alone?" That was the law. But because David's men were starving, they got to eat what was called the showbread. It was lawful for them because it was preserving life. And Jesus is reminding them of this. "Or have you not read in the law that on the Sabbath, the priests in the temple break the Sabbath and are innocent?" Someone's got to bake that showbread. Someone's got to have it there where it needs to be on the altar. And so the priests were allowed to bake bread on the Sabbath, because it was necessary for the temple. "But I say to you that something greater than the temple is here." What's greater than the temple? The idea here is that the temple serves the people, not the other way around. The Pharisees had taken the law and made it the key, the absolute. The people now served the law, but the temple was supposed to serve the people. "But if you had known what this means, 'I desire compassion and not sacrifice,' you would not have condemned the innocent, for the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath." And in the parallel Gospels, the Sabbath is made for man, not man for the Sabbath. Jesus is trying to get us to understand this. You know? Deuteronomy 23 allowed people to walk through a grain field, even one that was not their own, and pick what they needed to eat if they were hungry. You could do that. You know, they couldn't chase you off as long as you didn't use a sickle to harvest more than you could consume right on the spot. It was lawful. There was nothing wrong. Why are the Pharisees going crazy on Jesus here? Because what you had to do in order to eat the grain was you had to rub it. Get the chaff off so that you could eat the grains. And as soon as you did that, you were breaking their melacha against winnowing. Winnowing was an oral tradition that was constituting work on the Sabbath. That's what they were doing. They did not break the traditional. They did not break the Torah law. They broke the tradition. And Jesus defends it, saying, look, what's more refreshing on the Sabbath? To eat something as you're walking through a grain field. You know? What hypocrites you are. Look at the next one, Matthew 12, 9 to 14. Departing from there, this is right from the grain fields, he goes into the synagogue, and a man was there whose hand was withered. And they questioned Jesus, asking, and they're trying to test him now, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath, so that they might accuse him? And he said to them, what man is there among you who has a sheep and it falls into a pit on the Sabbath will not take hold of it and lift it out? That was lawful. You could do that. How much more valuable then is a man than a sheep? This is a Kalvei Homer argument that Jesus is using. Light and heavy. If something is true in the light instance, it's true in the heavy instance. And he's trying to get them, he's using their own teaching techniques to try to teach them. So then, it is lawful to do good on the Sabbath. And he said to the man, stretch out your hand. And he stretched it out, and it was restored to normal, like the other. But the Pharisees went out and conspired against him as how they might destroy him. Now, once again, to heal with a simple word is not unlawful. But these Pharisees had distinguished between was if you did something to heal a life-threatening injury, that was lawful. But if it was not life-threatening, then they had lots of restrictions about it. In other words, you couldn't even set a fractured bone. You couldn't try to restore a dislocation. You couldn't even pour cold water on a dislocated joint, you know, to try to heal it. But they said you could wash it in the usual way, and if it heals, it heals, you know. And so, in other words, the healing had to be a byproduct of something that was lawful. And Jesus was breaking that tradition. Even though he healed lawfully, he healed a non-threatening injury. Jesus is consistently putting a finger in their eye, always just at the tradition and not at the written law. John 5:5. A man was there, this is at the sheep gate, who had been ill for 38 years. When Jesus saw him lying there and knew that he had already been there a long time in that condition, he said to him, do you wish to get well? The sick man answered him, sir, I have no man to put me into the pool when the water is stirred up. But while I'm coming, another steps down before me. And Jesus said to him, get up, pick up your pallet and walk. And immediately the man became well, picked up his pallet and began to walk. Now, it was the Sabbath that day. Once again, non-life-threatening injury. The guy had been there for 38 years. Another day wasn't going to kill him. But what could be more refreshing on the Sabbath than get up? And again, to heal with the word, no big deal. But as soon as he said, pick up your pallet and walk, there was a melacha against transporting anything in public more than 4 cubits. A cubit is 18 inches. That was it. Pick up your pallet and walk. Once again, Jesus sticking his finger in the eye of the oral tradition, trying to separate those two, get the people to understand. This oral tradition is subverting the basic intent of what the law is there for. The Sabbath law. Last one, John 9. As he passed by, he saw a man blind from birth. And his disciples asked him, Rabbi, who sinned? This man or his parents, that he would be born blind? And Jesus answered, it was neither that this man sinned nor his parents, but it was so that the works of God might be displayed in him. Skip down to verse 6. When he had said this, he spat on the ground and made clay of the spittle and applied the clay to his eyes and said to him, go wash in the pool of Siloam, which is translated sent. And so he went away and washed, and the man came back seeing. Once again, non-life-threatening injury, heal with the word, okay, but as soon as you spit in your hand and you mix it with dirt and make clay, you are now kneading, you are building, you are breaking the oral tradition. Jesus is literally putting mud in your eye of the Pharisees. Here's mud in your eye. I think that probably came from this. He's literally doing that. Literally doing that. trying to get the Pharisees to understand, trying to get the people to understand. There's a difference between these two things. What is he trying to do here? Number four. Ask again. How are we supposed to view the law? The law, without a human heart present, desiring God's presence, desiring God's purpose, is as useless as a musical instrument without a skilled player's fingers. You can take the musical instrument, you can use it as a doorstop or a paperweight if you want to, but nothing approaching what it was designed for until someone is actually playing the instrument. We have to play the law. The law is not an absolute instrument to be obeyed or not mindlessly. We have to bring our whole heart and spirit to it. See the person that we're with. Make the choices that we need to make in order for us to be able to do what kingdom and love demands. Jesus on the law. How did he view the law? Important points. Keeping the law meant fulfilling the intent of the law, not just keeping the rules. Second, obedience and disobedience are both inward functions, not outward functions. I've told you the story several times of the little girl who wouldn't sit down to the dinner table, and finally her father says, "Sit down," and she does, and she glares around the table and says, "I might be sitting down on the outside, but on the inside I'm standing up." Okay? Obedience or disobedience are inward functions. You know there's a difference between giving up and surrender? Giving up is the end of resistance. Changes nothing. Surrender is the beginning of submission. Changes everything. Are we submitting inwardly? Is something changing inwardly? Are we moving away from just simple obedience into resonance with the King? This is what Jesus is trying to get us to understand. And as a corollary to that, three, outward rituals mean nothing if the heart's not right. We talk about sacraments all the time being the outward expression of an inward transformation. If there is no inward transformation, what does a sacrament mean? What does it mean to go get dunked in a river or dunked in the ocean if something hasn't happened inside to impel you there in the first place? What does matrimony mean if there is no consent to the actual promises that are made? Jesus says if you find yourself at the altar and you remember that you have something against your brother, leave the gift at the altar. Forget about the ritual. Go fix the relationship and then come back. Kill the bird if you want to. Don't kill the bird. Fix the relationship. Right? That's what's at issue here. It's easy to see the legalism in the Pharisees. It's easy to see their failures that Jesus is trying to correct. But how about us? You know, if you really think about it, we're much closer to the Pharisees than we are to Jesus' radical notion of freedom and kingdom. Gosh, we do this all the time. It reminds me of the old joke. I know I've said it in here before, but for some of you, why don't Baptists allow premarital sex? Because it could lead to dancing. Where is it written in the Bible that we're not supposed to dance? Jesus danced before the Lord, danced before the Ark of the Covenant, earned the disgust of his wife, but he danced. There's nothing wrong about dancing. Where is that thou shalt not drink? Jesus drank. He turned water into wine as his first sign. You know? Now we use grape juice instead of wine because, you know, there's something wrong. You know, that Puritan ethic coming back down again. And obviously, if you're drunk, there's a problem. But drinking alcohol, if it's not a problem, it's not a problem. It's not even unlawful. Wine was a symbol of celebration and joy to the Hebrew. Where is it thou shalt not smoke in the Bible? And yet how do we treat our smokers in most churches? We treat them like lepers, like pariah. You know, smoking. You know, why? Well, you know, there is a prescription against premarital sex. You know, and if you go to a bar and you drink and you smoke and you dance, maybe you're going to end up in bed with somebody. Oh, then don't do those things. Those are the hedges you see. But then what happens when the hedges become more important than the law, when the hedges become more important than the people that they're meant to serve? I love to tell the story of the old lady who walked out of one of our services saying over her shoulder, "There'll be no electric guitars in heaven, I'll tell you that." These cultural things that we hold so high that become more important than the law, what happens? What happens? There was a Valentine's dance that we had at another church. People left the church over the fact that the church held a dance. Broke their relationship over something that wasn't even unlawful. This is what we do. We're so much closer to the Pharisees than we would ever like to imagine or to believe. And Jesus is just not talking to the Pharisees of his day. He's talking to the Pharisees in every generation. He's talking to us. He's talking to us. Because in the final analysis, we always end up regressing. I'm going to read you one last paragraph. Left to our own devices, we will always regress back to legalism. From the fifth way back to the first four. From Malkuth back to Mamlaka. From kingdom back to mere obedience. It's basic human nature to see the world in two dimensions. From a flat, four ways perspective only. To long for the false security of the thick walls of a code that saves, quote-unquote, vicariously and without risk. Yeshua is calling us to engage fully and look at the world and our lives from another dimension. To say, as he did, that we are not here to either abolish the law or merely keep it, but to fulfill its deepest purpose. A purpose that can be summarized by simply loving God with your whole heart, mind, and strength, and our neighbor as ourselves. Such a purpose has no kinship with a mindless following of rules motivated either by an imagined quid pro quo arrangement with God for eventual personal gain or by a continual fear of punishment. Such a purpose is perfectly liberated and free, which means it is uncharted, untamed, undiscovered, and therefore feels unsecured and risky. But it is also centered in God's love, so all risk is ultimately removed. Torah law is a beautiful picture of who we really are, as God sees us, as we will become as we begin to choose relationship and enter kingdom, as we begin to become characterized by kingdom through the daily practice of the presence of God in our lives. Jesus told us that if we follow his ways, that the truth would make us free. Freedom is the goal. It's the effect of law's intent, freedom. We only need the law as long as we're not free. But once we're free, freely in love with Father, the effect is not anarchy. We become law, written on our hearts, free to do as we please without obedience. But what we please will fulfill the law and look like kingdom. For us, when this happens, heaven and earth literally will have passed away. Heaven and earth will have crossed their boundaries and merged into one, the fulfillment of the purpose of law. That's what Jesus is trying to get across to us. And he would say, he who has ears, she who has ears, let him hear. Let's pray. Father, thank you so much, Lord. Gratitude is the only position that makes sense in the face of everything that you give us continuously, every moment and every day. Help us to see that law is another gift that you have given us, a way for you to be able to guide us and show us what it looks like to live by your precepts, by your principles. Help us not to see it with fear. Help us not to see it as something we just need to mindlessly obey, but to engage with it, to dance with it and play with it so that we can see everything that you have for us every moment of our days. Thank you, Lord, for loving us the way that you do. Help us to remember we can only love because you loved us first. In Jesus' name, amen. Amen. Let's all stand.